This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 7th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station, WBAI, in New York. As Bush announces a permanent Office of Homeland Security, we look at how immigrants may be affected by the new measures. Reports of racial and sexual discrimination at the nation's three nuclear weapons labs. And the Seattle Musicians Union is taking their trumpets to the streets to protest the use of non-union actors and musicians. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S.-trained Filipino troops raided an Abu Sayyaf hideout in the Philippines today, ending more than a year-long hostage crisis in tragedy. Gurley Lanao is in Manila.
U.S. captive Martin Burnham and Filipino nurse Deborah Yap were killed in the rescue attempt by Philippine troops in Zamboanga del Norte province. Martin's wife, Gracia, was wounded in the fighting. She was rushed to a military hospital and has been declared out of danger.
There are reports that some ransom monies were paid to Abu Sayyaf.
There were several reports coming into the Philippines about ransom payments. First was that there was around $300,000 paid by family and friends. There were also reports that at least $1 million was paid by the U.S. government through the help of local government agencies also. Of course, both Philippine and U.S. government officials have denied any of the ransom payments, but the reports have been very persistent.
That's Free Speech Radio News correspondent Gurley Lanao reporting from Manila. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State rejected reports today that the United States would propose a joint military force to monitor terrorist activity in Kashmir. Greg Younger-Lewis has details from Delhi.
The American Deputy Secretary of State rejected reports today that the U.S. would propose a joint military force to monitor terrorist activity in Kashmir. Richard Armitage arrived in Delhi as part of an American diplomatic mission to reduce tension between India and Pakistan. The two countries have up to 1 million soldiers massed at their common borders. Earlier this week, a British newspaper reported the U.S. would lobby India and Pakistan to accept 500 British and American troops and numerous helicopters to help monitor the ceasefire line that divides Kashmir. The report said this would help stop the movement of terrorists to India from Pakistan. Armitage said the report was merely media speculation. India has instead offered to create a joint force with Pakistan to monitor the Kashmiri line of control. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Greg Younger-Lewis in Delhi.
A decade after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Bush administration has recognized Russia as a market economy. Joshua Chaffin is in Washington.
U.S. recognition of Russia as a market economy brings the country closer to membership in the World Trade Organization. The event is seen as a major win for Russian President Vladimir Putin. But Kutriana Glazebrook is skeptical Russia's new status will help the average Russian. Glazebrook directs the nonprofit Pacific Environment, which works to build civil society and environmental groups in the Russian Far East.
Because Russia is really suffering economically and socially now, what is happening is actually other countries like the U.S. and other multinational corporations are going into Russia and taking advantage of trade openings, and these profits are not going to local communities within Russia itself.
Glazebrook says the people and the environment would benefit more from trade liberalization if Russian leaders demanded local production of goods, not just extraction of natural resources by multinational corporations. Some Democrats on Capitol Hill are concerned recognizing Russia as a market economy will ultimately hurt jobs in their states. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The United Nations top human rights official says freedom must not be destroyed in the name of security. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson warned yesterday that the U.S.-led war on terror is threatening civil liberties around the world. Speaking in London, Robinson cited Amnesty International's recent annual report, which accuses governments from the U.S. to South Korea of grabbing emergency powers with little regard for rights. The UN's rights chief said the best response to what she termed the September 11th outrage is to increase human security by battling poverty, discrimination, and unequal trade. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
A tentative agreement has been reached in New York City, which will give the mayor control of the problem-plagued public education system. Ginger Otis has more.
New York City mayors have been trying to gain control of the public school system for more than 20 years. Yesterday, current Mayor Mike Bloomberg succeeded in doing just that. The announcement came after an extended tete-a-tete in City Hall with State Assembly President Sheldon Silver. The mayor told reporters he and Silver had come to a common agreement that the city's 1.1 million students would be better served under his tutelage. This tentative agreement will expand the board's numbers from 8 members to 13, with Mayor Bloomberg appointing 7 of the positions. He will also appoint the Chancellor of Education, who in turn will appoint 32 superintendents throughout the city. The agreement will not be final until it's been approved by the State Assembly and State Senate and signed by Governor George Pataki. If signed into law, the public school system would undergo its most significant overhaul in 3 decades. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ginger Rodas in New York.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
America is leading the civilized world in a titanic struggle against terror. Freedom and fear are at war, and freedom is winning.
In a 10-minute speech last night, President Bush told a national televised audience that he proposes to form a permanent Office of Homeland Security. Bush says he wants to increase the focus and effectiveness of government by creating a department that reviews intelligence and law enforcement information from all branches of government. And he encouraged all Americans to watch their neighbors.
Americans should continue to do what you're doing. Go about your lives, but pay attention to your surroundings. Add your eyes and ears to the protection of our homeland.
The new permanent Office of Homeland Security would also control the U.S. borders. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Joe Gardner-Wesley has been looking at congressional plans to reorganize the Immigration and Naturalization Service after September 11th. He looks at how the Bush proposal may affect immigrants living in the U.S.
The first and best way to secure America's homeland is to attack the enemy where he hides and plans. And we're doing just that. We're also taking significant steps to strengthen our homeland protections, securing cockpits, tightening our borders, stockpiling vaccines, increasing security at water treatment and nuclear power plants.
President George Bush said last night that he wants to combine the responsibilities of many different government agencies into one Department of Homeland Security.
This new agency will control our borders and prevent terrorists and explosives from entering our country.
Immigrant advocates and civil libertarians have been expressing concerns about government attempts to close the country to outsiders. Suzanne Jonas is professor of Latin American and Latino studies at the University of California in Santa Cruz. She studied immigration in the U.S. for years. Speaking before an audience in Albuquerque, Jonas observed that the government has reverted to the national security approach to immigrants, seeing them as threats.
This whole national security framework, you know, has been taken to the nth degree, meaning that permanent legal residents are as vulnerable as undocumented immigrants. So the line has been moved from the distinction between, if you say there's three categories, there's undocumented, there's permanent legal residents, and then there's citizens. The line used to be, so they said, between undocumented and permanent legal residents. That line has been shifted. The line now is between non-citizens, all immigrants, and citizens.
At a recent conference Jonas attended inside the Washington Beltway, she found Congress people had abandoned action on bills with immigrant rights provisions. Only bills that allow the importing of laborers are likely to pass. The federal government, she says, had been slowly undoing the anti-immigrant laws of 1996. Less than a week before September 11th, George Bush and Mexican President Vicente Fox had been working on a far-reaching amnesty program for Mexican immigrants, but now all that's changed.
Representative James Sensenbrenner, who is a moderate Republican and the head of the House Judiciary Committee, addressed the conference, and basically he said, if there's any legislation you're expecting to go through this year other than guest worker, forget it. He said, it's just not going to happen. He himself actually did not even vote in favor of some of the 96 laws, but in any case, he said, you know, in this environment, you're not going to get anything.
Sensenbrenner recently sent a bill to split the Immigration and Naturalization Service through the House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate has been preparing to vote on its own bill to restructure the INS. The House bill would split the agency into two bureaus, one that handles law enforcement and one that gives services to immigrants. Peter Simonson, director of the New Mexico chapter of the ACLU, thinks it's a good idea to split the INS up so it no longer has a conflict of interest between law enforcement and visa services. But he's less optimistic about Bush's proposal.
The president's comments last night, I think, suggest that we will see the drawing together of the INS functions, the Immigration and Naturalization Service functions, with counterintelligence activities. And I think the closer and closer those two are drawn together, the more and more we have to be concerned about, you know, this question of racial profiling, which now hangs like a pall over most of what the administration is doing.
Simonson worries about combining information analysis, surveillance, and infrastructure protection responsibilities of the CIA and FBI with the functions of the INS. He also finds announcements of new registration requirements for foreigners objectionable.
The Department of Justice will begin to require all immigrants to register with fingerprints and provision of other sorts of information, and then regularly to check in with INS offices or Department of Justice offices if they are people of Middle Eastern descent or Muslim background. And, you know, again, this raises the question of how does the government propose to do these things without infringing upon basic 14th Amendment equal protection rights?
Federal legislators who want to split the INS are responding to recent scandals, like when the agency sent visa renewals to two September 11th hijackers months after they had died. Marcela Diaz heads Somos Un Pueblo Unido, a Santa Fe-based immigrant advocacy group. She says such snafus come as little surprise.
These sorts of things happen all the time, usually to the detriment of honest, hardworking immigrants in the United States. People have they get their papers lost, they get their cases sort of lost in this huge bureaucracy, very little accessibility to INS when that happens. And so this is something that is very normal for us.
Diaz worries that an overemphasis on law enforcement will continue to beleaguer undocumented workers.
At the very least, what we can do in this moment is try to better the services that it provides, make their enforcement sector a little more accountable to our communities, because they really have in the past terrorized our communities. I mean, we've heard a lot within the last few months about how laxed INS is and how laxed our immigration laws are. But as advocates, we know that we're dealing with a very punitive set of immigration laws. And as I said earlier, the INS has received unprecedented resources and power to enforce those immigration laws.
Diaz thinks we need to focus on more realistic laws that reflect the reality of the economic situation both here and abroad. But Bush's promise to tighten the borders makes it seem unlikely that such legal reform will happen. With Leslie Fishburne Clark in Albuquerque, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley for Free Speech Radio News.
As the situation in India and Pakistan remains tense and the world focuses on whether they will go to nuclear war, in this country, the Federal General Accounting Office reports racial and sexual discrimination at the nation's three nuclear weapons labs. As KUNM's Leslie Clark reports from Albuquerque, in New Mexico that translates into lower wages and fewer promotions for Hispanic workers at Sandia Laboratories and Los Alamos National Lab.
The General Accounting Office found significant differences in the way Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, and women are treated versus white men. Disparities often ignored by management at New Mexico's Los Alamos National Laboratory, according to longtime worker Ben Maestas.
I would have to fight for my pay raises, whereas the Anglos, there'd be a kid, and he'd come in, and he would automatically get whatever the pay raise was going to be. With me, they'd bring it down a notch, but I already knew the Anglos, so that I would keep a log, and I would keep my prints. And when time came, you could hear me and my group leader just screaming up and down the hallway, Yes, you do. I get up and raise. No, you don't. Here's my stuff. Look it over. And of course, I would get it. But I seem to have to fight for it.
Maestra says working conditions are better now than in past years when he worked at the lab. He's among the retired Hispanic workers at LANL willing to speak out about discriminatory practices there. Those still employed at Los Alamos are mostly silent out of fear of retribution. The GAO study confirms anecdotal evidence by lab workers that management hasn't treated workers equally over the years. Ruben Montoya worked at LANL for 27 years before retiring in 1973.
If people were to go investigate Los Alamos 1973 back, you're not going to find any Hispanic girls that were group secretaries or anything like that, or any Hispanics that were in training for machinists or anything like that. You wouldn't find many that were staff members in Los Alamos. And some of these guys had degrees.
And Montoya says LANL hires Anglos for some jobs and Hispanics for others.
You won't find an Anglo janitor that worked in Los Alamos. Those jobs were made for Hispanics, Indians, and blacks. And the training programs that they had for machinists up there, they weren't made for Hispanics. They were made for Anglos that come in from New York, from New Jersey, from Pennsylvania, or wherever, you know.
Jonathan Garcia was hired at the lab in 1976. He says working conditions for Hispanics haven't changed much. Garcia spent 17 years trucking and burying contaminated materials at LANL's hot dump.
All the Anglo guys were getting all the overtime. There was quite a few Spanish, and we wouldn't get no overtime, especially where the money was at, you know. And we'd do it all week, and they would sit in the teepee. They would send him to the teepee, and he'd sleep half the day over there, you know, no work. And then come Friday, he'd take my place and work Friday, Saturday, and Sunday overtime, you know. And it would kill me because, I mean, you're talking about $200 or $300 on the side right there, you know, over a weekend.
The GAO report looked at the three national weapons labs during the 5 years from 95 through 2000. The report shows white males are paid more than white women and Hispanics, and there's a higher percentage of white males in management and professional jobs at the labs. Greg Mello with the Los Alamos Study Group, a longtime LANL watchdog, agrees the lab is a good place for white males to work. Mello says he's worried the larger moral issues of creating weapons of mass destruction are being submerged by what he calls petty squabbles.
Discrimination on the basis of anything is somewhat secondary to the quasi-criminal nature of the overall activity.
Officials at LANL refused to talk on tape, but lab spokesman Kevin Rourke issued a written statement supporting the lab's efforts to diversify its workplace and bring salaries to parity. However, Rourke states, Los Alamos Laboratory questions the methodology used by the General Accounting Office in its study. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque.
James Wolfenson, the president of the World Bank, delivered the commencement address to the graduating class of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology today. The choice of such a controversial commencement speaker sparked protest among the students and Cambridge community at large. From MIT, Chuck Racina has this report.
And for my own organization, which focuses so much on the question of poverty, for our organization, the question is, what is it that is the question of equity and social justice in that other part of the world, and how does it affect us in the privileged world?
Lofty words delivered by the president of the World Bank today as he came to Cambridge to speak to MIT's class of 2002. There is a strong anti-World Bank presence on the MIT campus. The MIT Thistle, a student anarchist publication, printed a special edition with a full back page calling for more world, less bank. Just last month, the Cambridge City Council voted unanimously to divest in all World Bank bonds. Although there was a steady rain, that did not dampen the day for those graduating or their families.
Do you have any comments on the controversy surrounding the commencement speaker?
I think it's great to bring some excitement to the graduation, and I hope there's a rally outside, just because most graduations get pretty boring, and this will really spice it up.
Do you know anything about the speaker, the commencement speaker, the World Bank president?
It's timely and controversial. So in some sense, I think it's a good idea.
To get the students and their family and friends to think about these issues, you mean?
Yes, that's right.
Thank you.
I think it's certainly an interesting choice for speaker for commencement.
Why?
Because of the protests and the demonstrations that you'll have against the director of the World Bank.
Mm-hmm. Is it bad that they chose him to be here?
I think it's inconvenient. We're here for the graduation. We're not here for, political demonstrations.
And I see you're holding a World Bank Grade F flyer. Yeah. Why?
Because that's what they deserve.
Why?
Because they're spreading misery all over the rest of the world. So I'm glad there's somebody out here giving these grades.
IMF and the World Bank! The IMF and the World Bank!
It'd be a little hard to conduct an interview around all this noise, but I see you're holding a big report card here.
Yes. Flunking the World Bank on several things. Like education, healthcare, environment, democracy, accountability, and playing well with others. The World Bank does not play well with others. World Bank beats other people up.
So they got F in all those categories, which means their report card is failing, so I guess they're not getting a diploma today, huh?
Well, apparently they're getting some sort of honor since the president of the World Bank is speaking at the commencement. MIT students challenged this, asked for another speaker, saying they don't want this guy at their commencement because of the World Bank policies, which are responsible for widespread poverty in the third world.
Security around the campus was tight. About 100 protesters were kept away from most of the pomp and circumstance by Cambridge and Massachusetts State Police.
Okay. It is our purpose and intent is to have as quiet a demonstration as possible and ask you to abide by the city's policy. You have a safe zone, a First Amendment zone that the state police has set up here. We would obviously prefer that you stay here. You can be visible. You may very well be able to get your messages across in this First Amendment area. We certainly hope that that is the decision you make. If you do not, then we'll take whatever action is appropriate.
Okay.
A police captain with the Cambridge Police Department not allowing protesters their right to assemble or speak freely, even though First Amendment rights are supposed to be granted throughout the land and not subject to police approval. Nonetheless, there was no confrontation and no arrests were made. Linda Pinko was a contributing reporter to this story. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina from MIT.
I said the system doesn't work no more.
What's that you said?
I said the system pushes down the poor.
What's that you said?
I said stop.
Smash the paint. Let's liberate.
The Seattle Musicians Union is leafleting and protesting the Seattle stop of the touring Broadway show, The Music Man. Last August, the AFL-CIO called a national boycott against the roadshow produced by Big League Productions and presented by Clear Channel Entertainment for using non-union actors and musicians. Thatcher Collins reports from Seattle.
Outside Seattle's Paramount Theater, 8 union trombonists play a song for the Music Man, 76 trombones. About 150 people joined them outside handing leaflets to concertgoers. When The Music Man started on Broadway in New York City, it was a union show. Marty Schmidt, an organizer with the local Seattle Musicians Union, says the policies of Big League, a specialist in non-union productions, is a significant new exception in Broadway road shows.
The touring musicians in this show have not been able to get union recognition or a contract. They've been trying since last August to negotiate something with Big League Theatricals, which is the producer of this touring Music Man. It's not the same producer as the Broadway show. The Broadway show is fully union. And when they filed a formal petition with the National Labor Relations Board, then Big League started threatening that if they persisted that they would basically keep the thing in the legal system long enough so that they would never be able to see any result.
The actors and musicians get paid roughly a third of the union pay. The money saved from lower wages and benefits goes to Big League, to Clear Channel, and to Seattle's Paramount Theater. the Paramount, also known as the Seattle Theater Group, then chose to sell the tickets for nearly full price.
Our local is in negotiations with the Paramount Theater at present, and we're trying to get contract language that would bar the engagement of non-AFM shows.
There's a new judge in town.
Clear Channel is one of the largest media corporations in the world and leverages its power in related industries to hurt its competition. Clear Channel owns 6,000 billboards, 18 TV stations, and 5 radio stations in the Seattle area. Clear Channel reportedly uses bans and virtual gag rules to penalize producers and consumers for using non-Clear Channel companies. Drew Murphy is a spokesperson for Clear Channel Entertainment in Seattle.
Their position is against or with Big League Theatricals and not Seattle Theater Group or not Clear Channel Entertainment.
Mater Snell, Secretary Treasurer of the Musicians Union, disagrees.
You know, who's driving the bus? Is it the Clear Channel or is it Big League Theatricals? And they're able to pass the buck between each other so that it's hard for the musicians or the organized labor to figure out who the boss is and who they're supposed to be bargaining with.
Eric Hensel faced Clear Channel as an organizer for the Painters Union in Cleveland.
You lose leverage if you don't have competition, because if you have genuine competition in a market, you know, somebody else is going to be taking some of your business if you're not able to get up your signs. But if it's all owned by Clear Channel, it doesn't matter because, you know, customers only have one place to go. If you're an advertiser, I mean, you lose also because they got all the signs.
The stagehands were recently organized for the Music Man with the help of the local union stagehands, who need to be hired for each specific venue. However, these stagehands signed a contract with a no-strike clause, preventing them from taking actions for other types of workers. Christopher Comte is a member of Actors Equity, the union trying to negotiate for the actors in The Music Man.
A majority of the cast of the show has actually signed cards requesting that Equity be their collective bargaining representative, and the producer of the show has actually refused to recognize the union as the collective bargaining agent for the actors. So it's actually gone to the National Labor Relations Board for a hearing, which was held at the end of last month.
In September, Clear Channel meets in Seattle as a member of the National Association of Broadcasters, a group that advocates broadcast media deregulation similar to the deregulation of the telephone industry and the energy market in California. I'm Thatcher Collins in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mester and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelly, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley in Albuquerque. On Free Speech Radio News, I can bring you reports on topics ranging from barriers to immigrant health care in the Southwest to a new federal school in Roswell for foreign police officers, stories which other news outlets won't often touch. But Free Speech Radio News can only stay on the air with your financial support. So won't you please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.